Please the court. My name is John Zach. I'm attorney registration 30089. Your Honors, this case is about CORA, Colorado Open Records Act, and the bottom line with respect to the appeal before this court is our position as the Colorado Republican Party. I'll refer to it as CRP, and I'll refer to the appellees as the representatives, if that's okay with the court. The bottom line is any applicant who is permitted to inspect a public record who has submitted an application for show cause pursuant to subsection 5, and the custodian previously denied that request for inspection, is a prevailing applicant by definition and is entitled to court costs and reasonable fees. That definition of prevailing applicant is not only evidenced clearly by the language in the statute, but it also vindicates the core values and primary purpose behind the Colorado Open Records Act, to wit, a strong presumption in favor of public disclosure, protecting the public's right to know what its government is doing. The legislative declaration in CORA says all public records shall be open for inspection by any person at reasonable times. This case presents a call to action for this court. This court must clarify how subsections 5 and 6 work together procedurally. It must clarify what a prevailing applicant means under subsection 5. And it must clarify the bright line tests that we believe are clear rules of law included in the language of the statute that vindicate that primary purpose, that make it easier for custodians to comply with CORA, that makes it easier for trial courts to manage these CORA cases and rule consistently, preventing abhorrent trial court decisions. It makes for efficient administration of CORA cases, not only with respect to how the custodians receive them, but also how the litigants pursue them, making them more cost-effective, less expensive. The bright line test under CORA, under subsection 5, is that an applicant under CORA prevails if just one document is improperly withheld, in which case attorney's fees and costs must be awarded to the applicant unless subsection 6 is properly invoked by the custodian of records.
This case law bright line test, or is that one that you're gleaning from the language of the statute?
Both, Your Honor. If we read subsection 5, it clearly mandates the procedure that is to be followed. Subsection 6 also mandates a clear procedure to be followed. And all of this flows logically from the Wick case. Wick says, in order to have disclosure ordered, which was done here, then there's prerequisite findings that a court must make. First, that there's a public record. That's not in dispute here. That it was withheld. There's no dispute as to the fact that the surveys at issue in this case were initially withheld by the representatives. That's why we have a case. And then finally, that the withholding was improper. You can't have a disclosure order without a prior finding of impropriety in the initial withholding of the record. And that's what Wick holds, and that's what the statute says. It all works together quite logically.
Wick's not talking about the disclosure of just one document out of many. And it's not, that's not the factual scenario that you...
No, Wick has a number of documents, but our position is that in order to fulfill the primary purpose of CORA, in order to vindicate the public's right to know, even one document being withheld is enough. Look at how CORA operates. First of all, applicants in CORA cases are going into these cases blind. For example, here in this case, the CRP and us as counsel, we've never seen any of the documents that have been withheld. The ones that weren't disclosed, that were reviewed in camera, we've never seen them. You're going into these cases at a factual disadvantage. That's what requires an absolute trust in the judicial mechanisms for judicial review of these cases. And furthermore, as far as I can tell, it's unique to CORA in this context. Where else in our jurisprudence, in our procedure, do we have litigants where one side knows all the facts and the other side doesn't?
Well, yeah. Your FOIA, it's the same thing.
No, and that's the same thing. We're talking CORA FOIA. The Wick decision stems from FOIA law.
Let me ask you a factual question. Judge Hyatt reviewed in camera the remaining undisclosed surveys sometime in, I guess, the summer of 2010. After Judge Hyatt reviewed them, how many more were disclosed?
After Judge Hyatt reviewed them, no more were disclosed because all the procedurally, the way it happened was CRP made a request in early 2006. That request was denied. Then CRP in March files a petition to show cause after providing notice to the representatives. We litigated that case. The position of the representatives through that litigation at the trial court, then presided over by Judge Naves, was none of these records are subject to disclosure. None of them are public records. We disputed that position, and Judge Naves ruled in our favor. We went up to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals adopted the position of CRP at the trial court level. They most certainly did. What they said was there's three categories of records. In record, two of those categories are subject to disclosure, and the language in the Court of Appeals opinion states that those records must be disclosed.
But didn't the Court of Appeals actually say the trial court's got to look at all of the surveys,
right?
And then if there are any that fit within these categories, they've got to be disclosed? And that never happened, right? It didn't happen because you started being fed voluntarily a bunch of surveys, and what the trial court ended up actually looking at was a smaller set, correct?
No, the trial court looked at everything.
It looked at everything.
Yes, sir.
Judge Hyatt did?
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry. What happened was after the case was submitted on appeal, prior to oral argument, the representatives voluntarily disclosed a large portion of records. This is after litigation was initiated, but they didn't voluntarily disclose pursuant to our initial request, only after they got an adverse ruling at the trial court and it was teed up at the Court of Appeals the first time.
And did the trial court look at those?
We don't know. I think the problem that the Court of Appeals had, and I argued the case at the Court of Appeals last time, the Court of Appeals could not tell by virtue of the initial order from Judge Naves and then the order on reconsideration, after which time, prior to the judge's order on the motion to reconsider, the representatives submitted all of the records, which they previously had not done. And we had no idea what they had submitted. Again, operating in the dark. What happens then is Judge Naves says, my first order stands. Nowhere in his orders did he indicate that he had reviewed all of the records at issue. And I think that's what the Court of Appeals didn't like. The Court of Appeals wants an in-camera review of all of the records that are subject to a petition to show cause.
But the question is, did Judge Hyatt review all of these, or just the ones that it was alleged that didn't have to be disclosed at all, and which he apparently agreed with?
No, Your Honor, the order from the trial court indicates that Judge Hyatt reviewed all of the
whole bunch. Okay.
All of the surveys.
Okay.
But again, it's after the fact. In order to show that there was a proper withholding, then no records should have been disclosed after the time of the initial request to the custodian. That's what Rick demands. Again, going back to the opinion from the Court of Appeals the first time, it finds that anonymous completed surveys are public records subject to disclosure under the court. That's on page 11 of the first opinion. Then the second one that says, completed surveys that merely express the constituents' positions on various issues without disclosing personal information that one would expect to remain confidential, such as details about their finances, health, or other circumstances. We conclude that these types of responses are also public records subject to disclosure under court. That's the law of this case. There's been an order from this court mandating disclosure. The CRP has prevailed. Now, the only way out of that is to invoke subsection 6.
Let me stop you for a second. I think I know where you're going, Mr. Zach. If you look at the statute, if you look at subsection 5, it says the court shall order inspection, right? Unless the court finds that denial of the right of inspection was proper, it shall order the custodian to permit such inspection. Now, Judge Hyatt never entered an order to the representatives directing inspection of reports, did he?
No, what happened was we stipulated to the fact that the subsequent to the opinion coming down from this court, The representatives would review all of the records that were not previously disclosed.
I understand.
And provide the certificate of compliance.
Judge Naves did enter an order permitting inspection, but that was reversed by our court, and then it was remanded, right?
It was remanded, and this court found that that disclosure was required.
So my question is, what is the order to the custodian to permit inspection that this sentence of Section 5 would apply to?
Well, Your Honor, we asked for an order discharging this case, a final order, and Judge Hyatt refused to give an order on that specific language. We teed it up for the court.
And so having not given such an order, how do we get to the next clause which says, and then shall award costs and fees? As my point is, it seems like there was never technically an order to the custodian to make inspection. So how could you go to the next clause which say, and then you shall award fees?
The judge refused to give the order that was required of him by the statute.
You're not appealing that to us, are you? You're appealing the fee or the fee.
They're one and the same logically. One has to follow the other. We asked for an order that said, Your Honor, said to the parties, disclosure is completed and in compliance with the law. There would be no disclosure. I mean, the representatives can't argue here that we've gone through 5 years of litigation and they just voluntarily disclosed. I mean, this case forced them to disclose these records. And as a result of that disclosure through this litigation, we prevailed. That means that we're entitled to fees. I think it's very clear from the language.
Prevailed, I guess, on, you say 58% of the documents that you requested, and they prevailed, I guess, on 42%, something like that, I think, of the percentages you throw out.
The language is prevailing applicant, Your Honor, and we applied for disclosure of public records. We didn't know how many records there were. We didn't know whether all or some or the majority or the vast majority were going to qualify as public records. That's the factual disadvantage that comes in court cases. Think about the slippery slope that would come about if you were to decide this case that it's based on a majority of records. It would entice custodians to play games with this statute. That's not what this is about. This is bright line law stuff here.
You're saying even if one document was disclosed, attorneys, under such an order, attorney's fees should be awarded even if 9,000 documents were withheld.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so I want to make clear that what's in front of us on appeal here. Judge Hyatt's order said the court finds that the initial denial of the right to inspection was in many respects proper. And I take it that your first point on appeal is it's those words in many respects that makes the court's order error.
Not only is that error, in order under Rick, in order for the court to find anything other than disclosure was the failure to disclose, the withholding was improper, is completely illogical under the reading of this statute. Because they had to disclose, absolutely, as a matter of fact and logic, the prior withholding was improper.
Because there were some documents that had to be with.
Absolutely.
And your argument is that, I take it, that even if it was just one document, that goes to the issue of reasonableness of fees, not to whether fees should be awarded in the first place.
I don't think that it goes to reasonableness of fees either.
Why not?
Well, because reasonableness of fees is whether or not the, you use the standard of whether or not the work associated and billed was at a reasonable amount for the quality and qualification of the lawyers, and whether or not the results obtained met with what was being sought by the party. Here, we have no counterclaim whatsoever by the representatives. There's only one claim. We prevailed on that one claim. We're entitled to 100% of the fees at a reasonable rate and given the success of the work.
But you acknowledge that the other side makes an argument to the contrary, and that's not something that we can resolve on appeal, is it?
Certainly. You've got an order denying fees. You've got all of the evidence that was presented to a trial court or that would be presented to a trial court in resolving the issue of fees. And so it's here for you now. Decide it now rather than sending it back down and having another appeal on this case yet again in a case that should be handled expeditiously pursuant to the statute come before you again. I'll reserve my last 10 seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Bender, registration number 33979, representing Appalese in this matter. Judge Hyatt, as Mr. Zakim just indicated, reviewed each and every survey at issue in this case. The judge considered what was disclosed and what was withheld, and he concluded that the denial of the right of inspection was proper and that no one prevailed. The conclusions are supported by the record and should not be reversed on appeal. I'd like to make a few points in response to Mr. Zakim's argument initially. With respect to the purpose of CORA, while there is a general presumption in favor of disclosing public records, it's a more nuanced approach in this case. There needs to be a balancing approach with the type of documents that we're talking about here. We're talking about communications between constituents and their elected officials, and there is an exception to disclosure under CORA that provides that if there's a clear implication of confidentiality in those records, then those documents are not subject to disclosure.
Wasn't it the position of your clients that there was a clear implication of confidentiality and therefore they shouldn't be disclosed?
Yes, Your Honor.
So there wasn't your position that we don't know if we should disclose them or not under 6A. That wasn't your position.
That is correct.
Until the attorney's fees came up.
It was our position that the exception applied. With respect to Mr. Zakim's point that this court's prior opinion vindicated CRP's position in this case, it's just not accurate. Again, as Judge Loeb indicated, the holding in the Court of Appeals in that first opinion was that each and every one of those documents needed to be reviewed by the district court. Some of them were likely subject to disclosure, and some of them likely were not. So the case was remanded for that, which incidentally was what the representatives advocated all along and were willing to and ultimately did provide all those documents for an in-camera review.
Court of Appeals say more than it was likely. Didn't they say review them all? But if you find any in these categories, they do have to be produced. They didn't just say it was likely.
Correct. Thank you. In my argument, I'd like to first talk about the standard of review, because I think it's a somewhat complicated issue in this case, and it's not, from our perspective, a straightforward de novo review. It is true that the interpretation of CORA is subject to a de novo review, but embedded in the CORA fee-shifting provision in 2045, the district court has the ability to make fact findings. And reading from the language of the statute, it says, unless the court finds that the denial of the right of inspection was proper. And the district court did, in fact, make a fact finding. In context, again, Judge Hyatt reviewed each of the surveys at issue in the case and evaluated what was and what had and hadn't been disclosed.
Counsel, doesn't what's proper require construction of the statute as to what proper means within the statute?
It may be that it's a mixed question of there may be legal application in there, but clearly there is a fact finding that's made by the district court.
It looks to me like a mixed question of law and fact, which I think is what you were about to say or part of what you were saying there.
It is. It's complicated. I do think that there is a component of the fee shifting provision that does have room for a clearer standard of review. And I do believe that Judge Hyatt in his order, when he determines that the denial of the right of inspection was proper, that is a fact finding. That's our position.
Well, if we determine that it's a mixed issue of law and fact, aren't there a number of different types of standards of review that we're allowed to pick from?
Yes.
And one of those is de novo, correct?
Well, I would stand by my argument that the component of the statute that permits a fact finding should be subject to a clearer standard.
Right. But if the trial court made a determination that withholding some of the documents was proper, or whether it was proper to withhold the documents, doesn't that require us to look at the statute and determine what is proper and what isn't proper withholding?
It does, Your Honor, but to do so, it must be done in context. And that context is the factual and procedural sort of workings of the case.
Well, so let me take off from there then. I mean, the judge uses the word proper or properly twice, as near as I can tell. It says he finds that the response to the petitioner's request was viewed in context proper. And then he says it's clear that the majority of the surveys were properly withheld. And then he says the court finds that the initial denial was in many respects proper. But he never says flat out that the denial was proper. He always says either in many respects or in context. And so, as Judge Terry said, doesn't that then force us to decide a question of law in terms of whether the court has properly applied the statute on what proper means?
Well, application of the statute is subject to de novo review, and we do agree with that. Again, I think that based on what was involved in the determination of what was proper, it incorporated a fact finding. It involved a review of each of those 1,584 surveys and a review of precisely what the representatives had produced and what the representatives had withheld.
I want to move on to your argument about the prevailing party standard and that the trial court properly looked to the prevailing party standard. The concern I have is there's nothing in CORA that indicates that anything other than a prevailing applicant gets fees. In other words, there's nothing that says that the custodian gets fees, or if the custodian wins part of the case, then the applicant doesn't get any fees. Can you please address that?
Well, I can, and I hope I'm answering your question in leading with it's sort of the theme of my argument that this isn't as straightforward as CRP suggests, at least from our perspective. These are shades of gray. The statute doesn't say that if you compel disclosure of a document, then you automatically get fees. There are two qualifiers from our perspective. The denial of the right of inspection must be proper, and you only get fees if you are a prevailing applicant. So there's no definition of prevailing applicant in the statute. It's reasonable, and as Judge Hyatt determined, applicant in this context is analogous to party for a provision.
But how can it be? Because there's no provision for the custodian to get fees in 2045, is there? Is it your position that the custodian can get fees under 2045?
I don't know offhand if the custodian is able to get fees. I think there actually may be a provision in 2045 that allows fees for the custodian. I can provide clarification on that point subsequent to the argument. I will say, at least with respect to the word applicant, I think it's a distinction without a difference between prevailing party. First of all, CRP repeatedly refers to itself as a party, but perhaps most importantly, it makes sense that the prevailing applicant can be entitled to fees because the person who is seeking documents in the first instance has to make an application to the district court.
I think if you look at the last sentence, you'll see it says that the court can award fees to the custodian if the claim is found to be frivolous or vexatious. So it seems like the government entity is called the custodian, the other person is called the applicant.
Thank you.
Whether they're parties or not, I'm not sure the terminology matters. Sorry.
Thank you for the clarification. I thought there was something in there for the custodian.
Might save you some time.
I'd like to talk about Section 2045, again, the two findings that are required in order to support an award for fees in this case. First, the denial of the right of inspection, whether or not it's proper, and again, whether the requesting party is a prevailing applicant. The required finding of whether the denial of the right of inspection is proper, again, it's not as straightforward an analysis as I ask for a document, you don't give it to me, I get it, I get fees. It's not the way it works. There are qualifiers in the statute. It's not the way the statute reads. The Miller case, I think, is instructive of an instance in which a district court determined that a document that had been previously withheld was ultimately ordered to be produced. But the custodian in that case was unable to produce that document because of a protective order. So the district court vacated that provision of the protective order and ordered the document produced. In that case, however, after a fee application, it was still determined that the denial of the right of inspection was proper. So the district court considered the history and the outcome of the litigation in making this determination. The end result was mixed in this case. the Republican Party repeatedly refers to the result in this case is enough to win any contest imaginable. There's really no precedent for that approach. There is, however, significant precedent in the prevailing party case law that there are cases where the result is sufficiently mixed.
Let me ask you, counsel, if you have a case where the applicant is seeking one document and one document only, and the court orders production of that one document, would you say that the applicant prevailed?
I can't go that far again because of the analysis in Miller, I think.
Assuming there's no protective order.
I do think that it would be more reasonable to conclude that the denial of the right of inspection was not proper in that instance. Again, that's...
But why is it different if you seek 10,000 documents and you get one?
Because this was a completely mixed result. I mean, the end game in this case was that some of the documents were subject to disclosure under CORA and were produced, and others were within the exception and were withheld. So it's much more analogous in my mind to a prevailing party.
Couldn't the legislature pretty easily have prevailing party? I mean, there was plenty of law out there before CORA was enacted. People knew what prevailing party meant.
It could have done that. That's true.
So why should we construe? Aren't we required to assume that the legislature used particular words for a reason, and that if it meant prevailing applicant or prevailing party, it would have said those words?
There's certainly case law for that proposition, Your Honor, and I'm not debating that. I do think that it's reasonable to conclude in this instance that applicant means party, both because the court and the Republican Party have referred to the parties as the party, and also the way...
But as Judge Richmond just pointed out, there's another provision that allows the custodian and only the custodian to get fees. Why shouldn't we assume the prevailing party, prevailing applicant, refers just to the person seeking the documents?
Well, even if you go that direction, there's still the qualifier in the statute that about whether the denial of the right of inspection is proper. So there are two components to 2045 that need to be addressed.
So even if we apply the prevailing party analysis, at least didn't the CRP prevail in part, like Judge Hyatt found?
No. I think that Judge Hyatt found that the denial of the right of inspection was proper and that CRP didn't prevail in this instance.
But the total result of the lawsuit was that they got, I don't know, 782 or something more surveys than they had when they filed their request, and your clients denied inspection.
Well,
so they did prevail to that extent, even though it was through the graces of your turning things over. It's sort of like a catalyst theory, I guess I would think.
Well,
and I know the catalyst theory in class actions isn't maybe recognized, but that's kind of what we have here.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Ultimately, if you look at the really what was going on in this case, they didn't prevail. They didn't get what they wanted. And if you look at the request that was submitted at the height of the legislative session, asking for thousands of documents, they wanted the backers, the financial backers of a group called Research and Democracy.
Yes, but they got documents. They didn't get the ones that had the words in it that they wanted, but they got documents. Why are we supposed to look at that and say, we didn't get what you wanted because it didn't have the words, research and motion, whatever it's called, on it?
Because they got some, but they didn't get everything. And there is discretion afforded to the district court to determine whether that denial of the right of inspection was proper.
I need to clarify something before your time runs out, counsel. Are you asking us to look at a defense under to attorney fees under 2046A or B or some combination thereof?
Yes, I think that the inquiry can end certainly with an analysis of 2045. Again, with those two points that we've been talking about, whether
okay,
the denial
but so even though you're invoking 204, I think it's 6B, saying that you can do it defensively, aren't you still required to meet the requirements of 2046A, which requires the custodian to say that they can't, in good faith, determine whether the document needs to be produced? And you never asserted that, did you?
We didn't assert that we couldn't determine that, but I don't.
So how do you fit within that safe harbor?
I don't think that 6B requires that procedural posture from the custodian.
You think 6B stands alone and you don't have to meet the requirements of 6A?
Well, 6B says basically that in defense against an application under 5, and we have an application under 5, you can raise any defenses.
Great, but that doesn't get rid of the attorney fees in A unless you meet the requirements in A, does it?
Well, I think the statute refers to the defenses that you can raise. I think it says the custodian can raise any defenses against an application that's made.
Okay, but 6B doesn't provide its own attorney fee safe harbor, does it? The only attorney fee safe harbor is in 6A, so don't you have to meet the requirements of 6A in order to get into the safe harbor?
Well, no, I think 6B says that you can use anything in defense of a fee provision under, or a fee application under 5.
What's an issue that you can raise under 6A besides we don't know if we can disclose these? Are you saying there's others?
There's several, yeah. In the statute, there's reasonable diligence and inquiry. There's a public interest exception if disclosure of documents is contrary to the public interest.
And all of those you made all those? That's your claim? You made all those defenses?
We did make all of those defenses, Your Honor.
Your time's up, counsel. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
How much time, Mr. Zakim?
Thank you, Your Honor. The first Court of Appeals order is the order of disclosure to the custodian, for the record. Also, take a look at subsection 5.5A. Prevailing party is the standard there. The legislature used both terms within this within section 204. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. Case will stand submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course.